Bienvenidos sean todos ustedes, amigos míos, queridos radioescuchas, viñeteros de mi corazón. A una emisión más de este su podcast favorito de entretenimiento friki, animación, cómics y todo eso que nos gusta. Yo soy Ino, saludándolos de este lado del micrófono, de este lado del monitor. Y junto a mí se encuentra de manera virtual la belleza incomparable y la opinión siempre precisa de Renata, mi adobada García. ¿Cómo estás?
Hola, y no, bien, ¿y tú?
Bien, muchas gracias. Una semana que pinta interesante, una semana que pinta muy divertida para mí.
Oye, pero antes de que sigas hablando, nada más
Ajá.
tengo que decirles a todos los que
Ajá.
nos escuchan que este
Oh.
fin de semana fue tu cumpleaños. ¡Felicidades!
Gracias, gracias, gracias. Pero yo ya llegué a la edad en la que no cumplo años. Qué oso cumplir años ya a mi edad. Al rato voy a llegar a la edad en la que me empiezan a regalar andaderas, pañales para adulto. No, ya no, ya. Ya,
Oye,
mejor
está
ya
bien
no
que te regalen esas cosas porque son caras.
cumplo. Yo no sé de eso. Este episodio, sobre todo, pinta bastante, bastante interesante porque, como les comentamos la semana pasada, el animador, artista de board, artista de fondos, de layout, multitask, Chris Byrne, estuvo bien platicar con nosotros, nos regaló unos minutos de su tiempo y realmente platicamos de una manera, pues, muy relajada. Él como que quería platicar más que fuera entrevista y estuvo bastante padre, la verdad. Platicamos de cosas bien chidas y nos moríamos de ganas por compartírselos.
Sí, nosotros así de no, pero eso todo sobre ti, cuéntanos tú.
Sí, se trata de ti, Chris. ¿Nosotros qué? Y él, no, pero ¿ustedes qué opinan? ¿Cómo lo ven ustedes? Nosotros, ay.
Pues que está padre.
Está
No,
bueno,
pero estuvo bien
señor.
padre.
Sí, estuvo bueno. Así es que si ustedes, aprovechando también, ya llegamos a los 500 suscriptores. Ya pasamos de los 500 suscriptores. Muchísimas gracias a todos ustedes. Lo prometido es deuda. Vamos a hacer una rifa, vamos a rifar lo que ya los hemos prometido, estamos consiguiendo más cositas, pero de aquí a que es la rifa, vamos a, pues, juntarlo todo y mandar el paquetazo a quien resulte ganador o ganadora. Tienen exactamente 15 días para decirle a sus primos, amigos, hermanos, mamá, papá, todos que nos sigan porque en 15 días, en 2 semanas, vamos a hacer la rifa de todo el paquetazo del paquetazo
Sí, ¿por qué?
Pues porque no propones nada, ya se quedó así. Paquetazo billetero para de regalo, señor Aguilera. ¿Cómo no?
¿Qué tenemos en la cabeza número 2 que nadie quiso?
Y bueno, 15 días, en 15 días, 2 semanas, vamos a hacer el sorteo. No importa de qué parte del mundo nos escuchen, no importa. Vamos a hacer el sorteo, todos participan mientras nos sigan en YouTube. Van a ser los seguidores de YouTube los que participen en esta dinámica, porque es lo que estábamos buscando, 500 seguidores en YouTube. De todas formas, nos falta un montón para llegar a la meta, 1500 antes de que termine el año. Por favor, ayúdenos. Ayúdenos a llegar a esa meta. Y ya que andan por
Háganlo por
acá,
Ino, que fue su cumpleaños.
anden y regálenme de cumpleaños. Jalen, jalen gente. Y viene el de Renata todavía a mediados de noviembre, ¿eh? Entonces, por
Justo la mitad.
favor, justo la mitad. Por favor, ayúdenos. Ayúdenos, apiádense de estos comunicadores de la animación. Por
Sí.
favor, pobres comunicadores de la animación.
Déjame tocar una canción triste para ti en el violín más pequeño del mundo.
El drama, pero bueno, yo
Oh.
digo que ya pasé, ya antes de seguir con nuestro drama, pasemos a la entrevista, ¿no?
Sí, denle por favor like al video, compártanlo, suscríbanse, sigan a Renata en redes, renatagp.art en Instagram, guión bajo art en Twitter, porque...
Twitter no acepta puntos.
Y yo estoy como divino con arroba, pues sí, divino con H intermedia, Divino, divino en Instagram y en Twitter. Entonces, sin más preámbulos, la entrevista, damas y caballeros, con Chris Byrne. Córrela. Chris Byrne. It's an honor to have you here with us.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Ever since the Don't Bluth features, your path through Aardman, Disney and Sony, now Netflix and DreamWorks, you've seen the animation industry in the US or in North America grow and develop. Do you like what you've seen so far?
Yeah, because I still have a job, so it's I think it's a really cool time because there's a lot of opportunity and there's a lot of content. So it's sometimes hard to, you know, kind of get through the noise and find, you know, the stuff that you're after. But as far as making the work, there's a lot of opportunity, which is great for myself and all the artists out there in the world, I think, which is pretty cool. How are you guys finding it in Latin America?
Oh well, in terms of Latin animation, it's growing, as I was saying, it's growing a lot. And you know, in Peru, the animation is amazing. And in Mexico, we have more studios. Spain is doing some beautiful things, you know, like Klaus with Spa.
Yeah.
So it's beautiful. It's a lot of content down here.
Yeah, it's good. It's good times.
Yeah, there are more opportunities opening for all of us, which is always a great thing.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you how it has been adjusting to the new technologies working in animation.
I don't know. I think it's one of those things where, like, after doing this for about 25 years, it's like the technologies are always kind of changing. And sometimes I don't even feel like technology is like the day they took pencils out of our hands and they made us like stop drawing on paper and put screens in front of us. It didn't feel like technology. It felt like somebody murdering a craft. And then, you know, at some point you realize, it's just, it's the same. It's the same skills, it's the same muscles, it's the same brain work. It's just the tools are adapting and changing. So I think that's one of the things that I think the fear has come down about change over the years. And I think as I've gotten to, you know, do different things in film, like I'm excited about some of the new advancements. Like I'm really excited about real-time camera and real-time rendering and just sort of like how that's going to affect the ability to tell a story or how to, you know, move in a more immediate way when it comes to making what we make. And, you know, as much as I love the thought process behind animation, sometimes it's frustrating how long it takes to kind of get to a place where you can make really concrete decisions. So as the technology gets better, our filmmaking abilities, you know, kind of evolve. So I don't know. But then there's things I miss too. Like I kind of miss the, you know, the way that storyboards used to be more illustrations and they would provide sort of a platform for a movie, not literally making the movie exactly as the movie is going to be seen, which is putting a lot of pressure on, I think, that early phase. But it's just I think it's a question of always trying to find that communication with the audience while you're making is evolving. Yeah. I don't know. How do you feel about it?
Well, as you're saying, the storyboarding process, it has evolved in some crazy way. Now you have to be an actor. You have to be a director. You have to be a layout artist. You have to be able to deliver some really cleaned up version of the storyboard. You have to be such a complete artist to deliver good storyboarding nowadays.
Which is great. I mean, that's great. Like, the thing that is, I think, a little challenging is like the mentorship process is slightly different. Like I know when I came into the business, when we were all drawing on paper, there was a real sense of kind of like you had to learn to draw before you could learn to act, before you could learn to sort of like really own sequences. And so like there was a way to kind of come into the business and take those baby steps. And now it seems like right out of college, you're expected to do everything. And it's gotta be hard on young people in terms of that expectation. But I'm just amazed at the talent that I've seen come up in the last 10 years.
That's true, because when I first started doing storyboard, I was working like in, you know, publicity. And after that, when I moved to animation, it was like, oh my God, I need to know cinematography and animation and this and this and that for the storyboards. It was challenging. So it's true what you're saying. But I think it's moving rather well.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, you throw people into the deep end and, you know, if you're ambitious and, I mean, we all come in with a point of view because it's like we wouldn't be here if we didn't love movies and, you know, art and comics. So it's kind of the dream thing, isn't it? You know, when you get an opportunity to be that person.
Right? Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. It's great. What we do is great. So how was it when Netflix gave you Corey and Rob the Willoughbys?
Well, they'd actually give it to us. We were working on it for about a year and a bit. It was an independently financed feature in Vancouver. It was a studio called Bronze. Right. They do largely live action films. So they did that movie Fences with Denzel Washington and The Joker. They had a big piece of that last year. So, you know, we were kind of this little awkward stepchild to their operation over here, kind of muddling along making cartoons. And I had a long relationship with Greg Taylor over at Netflix, and I knew Melissa from working with the DreamWorks organization in China. And so when she came in to run Netflix, it was one of those opportunities where, you know, the door kind of opened and, you know, you kind of milk the relationships that you have in the industry, and went down and showed them an early just the early kind of progress on the film. And then they came up and kicked the tires and saw the studio. And at the time, they were just opening up that feature division. So I think we were the second movie that they acquired after Klaus. So it was from that point on, it was like Pinocchio becoming a real boy. Like, we were suddenly, we had a real deadline. We had a real distribution channel. We had real money on the table, and the movie was going to get made. But that was it was kind of crazy circumstances. Like, if you think about how anything gets made, it's nutty.
Yeah, you have been grooming a project, so after so you can afterwards, as you said, you have to milk your contacts in the industry.
I like all these farm metaphors. Yeah, it's a bit of milking, and it's also like planting seeds in the ground. I always find, like, especially like when you're kind of developing things, like it's like trying to get 10 things going, and you just hope that one of them takes, or one of them, like, you know, sprouts and turns into something. And actually, the other fear is that you get 10 of them going, and then it's like, how am I going to get everything done? So it's like there's a little bit of that kind of spinning plate things where you're trying to be honest but lying all the time. It's like, yeah, no, this is all going to be working right.
But that's a better. That's a better problem to have, you know, to have 10 projects at the same time rather than none.
yeah. And the line between none and 10 is pretty narrow. Like, you know, it's like you can go, I don't know how many like weeks I'll go like 5 days a week and have nothing much kind of catching. And then Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock, suddenly there's three things going, and it's like, oh shit, how am I going to get that done?
I know.
Yeah. This industry is unpredictable.
Yep. Well, it's not there for us. It's there for the business. So it's like, we're just there to be around when they need us, right? To get stuff on the screen. So.
Yeah, that's true. I was going to ask you, being a part of this select group of creatives working in new content for Netflix, how did it feel, you know, like doing all this now that you're in that platform?
I mean, there was moments where it felt very traditional, like, you know, making a feature is, you know, the process is pretty worked out in terms of, you know, years of the Hollywood system. So we had screenings and we had, you know, executive notes, and we would go through the, you know, challenges of trying to understand what the movie wanted to be, and then like kind of fighting for that 85 minutes of content. And then on the other hand, you know, the muscles that I was used to when you were working on a big, you know, kind of box office feature where it's a platform movie for a studio and you're trying to hit a four quadrant audience. It's a different agenda, I think, with the streamers. I think it's because it's coming directly into the audience's living room. And, you know, so we could take risks in ways that I was really thankful for. And I enjoyed the fact that, you know, the movie was allowed to be what it wanted to be, as opposed to trying to kind of smooth it out and make everybody happy. So when we have a screening and we would get like kind of varying results from like the kid audience and the adult audience, I mean, quite often we would, like, you often get like really favorables with kids, but then the adults want, you know, the movie to kind of round around the edges. And we weren't really pushed to do that. Like, we still made decisions based on what we learned, but it was more to try to serve what the movie wanted to be, which was a refreshing thing in terms of the creative. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
You were in California, or you were directing?
Mostly in Vancouver, actually. So we had a studio in Vancouver proper, and then right off the coast of Vancouver, there is a big island called Vancouver Island, which doesn't contain the city of Vancouver. That's confusing, but you have to go back 100 years to change that bit of logic. So there was a little town on that island called Duncan, and we had about 10 animators there. And then I had a small studio back east in Ontario, where I had some pre-production hubs. So that's where a production designer was, and we did a bunch of boarding. So it was kind of made in three places across Canada.
I feel that that was a good practice to adapt to the situation right now, don't you think? Like, since now we are all working from home, I feel that, it was kind of similar.
It's funny because it's like, I think, like I have a lot of friends in animation, as I'm sure you guys do, who have been social distancing for their entire career. So it's like, I miss being in a studio, but I mean, we've been kind of building the muscles of like working remote and doing this a lot in terms of Zooming and communicating this way.
Yeah,
that's true.
We watched you in a talk you had with Jorge Gutierrez a few weeks ago. And when you went, or you had to go to California when you were developing the movie, the feature, did you happen to you know, came across a hole with Glenn Keane or somebody like that? How did it feel?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't run into Glenn at the studio, but like through, as you start to get to a place where, you know, you're shopping the movie, you end up at these festivals and stuff. So that's every time I've run into Glenn, it's kind of been in those scenarios where we're presenting the stuff we're making. And it's a real, I mean, it's a head scratcher when you meet these artists that you're, you know, kind of you grew up admiring. Like, you know, Glenn goes back to, Fox and the Hound and all those early Disney films. And it's, the fact that he was trained by the Nine Old Men is pretty amazing. Actually, I loved his father's comic. I loved comics when I was a kid. So Bill Keane's work was like, you know, always coming into my house when I was a kid in the newspaper. And so like to actually kind of get to know Glenn and sort of see him as a creator and as somebody who's like, kind of making or going through the same struggles that I was going through in terms of trying to get a movie off the ground. It was pretty cool. It's pretty cool. It's a small industry, though. I guess the thing I really love about animation people, I don't know if you guys have found this, but like the ones that do well and sort of seem like they climb the ladder and get to like the top creative positions, that not many of them are assholes. Like they're kind of like, it's really nice people. And I think it's because we move so slow. Like there is an empathy that sort of has to be part of the process, you know, in terms of like, you know, it is it's hard work and it's not an easy skill to develop, but like, and I don't think like there is a lot of creators that don't suffer fools, but I think in terms of being able to talk about what they do and share their experiences, it's a very collaborative industry, which I'm thankful for.
Yeah. That's true, because we have said it before in this show that the animation, you're not just one person making a movie, so you need to like have a good good sense of community with all your team, and that evolves to the whole industry.
And you mentioned Jorge, and just sort of like how like anybody in the industry, when you say Jorge's name, their face lights up. And I think he just brings that energy to people, which is what you need when you're slogging for 5 to 8 years on a project. You know what I mean? It's a real war of attrition. So like having that kind of joyful persona that's not fake, like he's a really happy person that is excited to be in the process of making these things. And I don't know, I think that's a real important skill for what we do.
Yeah, and as you say, they're not assholes. The ones that are on the top, I'm not gonna be name dropping about who I've talked about, but they are not assholes, as you say. And some people may think, especially youngsters, would think that they could be, but the more people I know that are up there, the more I understand how it is. You know, how just as you've said, it's a small industry, and we learn a lot as we climb to the top. We are climbing.
Yeah, it's so humbling. Whenever you feel like you've done it and you've made it, like something will come along to take you out the kneecaps. And then I can't tell you how many times, like during the journey of making any of the films, but like most recently on the Willoughbys, like how, like on my worst day, it was my editor, like Fiona, or like my production designer, Kyle, or, you know, even just, you know, a lighter on the team, you know, who's slogging through a shot, who kind of gets it to work, and that gives you hope. And it's just, and like collecting those great ideas from really smart people is a big part of the, I think, the process. And so giving room for people to do what they do, and the permission to take risks. And that's, I don't know, that's how we learn, and that's how we make a better thing.
Yeah, humbling. It's a nice word.
That's a word.
Yeah.
Hey, so you kind of mentioned a little bit of comics a moment ago, and I really like that, because I was about to question you, what kind of comic book stories do you enjoy the most?
Well, I mean, when I was a kid, I lived on a farm, so we were right in the middle of nowhere, and so there was no corner store to get like the superhero stuff. So I used to get all the comics either through the school or through just in the newspaper. So really, like, the Saturday morning funnies were my thing. So it was like, I don't know if you guys know, like, Calvin Hobbes, so Bill Watterson, and yeah. Farside. Like, to me, Farside was the perfect form of art. It was one panel, just the layers of funny, and I could read those books over and over and over again. There was a comic in Canada called Herman that was illustrated by a guy named Jim Unger, and it was just a single panel setup too. And I just loved the way he could draw ugly funny. And he found, you know, joy in the sublime kind of banalities of life, of just sort of like, you know, sad people waiting for a bus. He could find a joke there. And so then, of course, there were like narrative stuff, like For Better or For Worse, which was Lynn Johnson's stories. I love those. And Bloom County by Bill Breathed. So all those sort of like kind of like panel comics were like a big influence when I was a kid. And then as I got older, it kind of moved into sketch comedy. You know, I love like Kids in the Hall and SCTV and Saturday Night Live. And so I think those two things kind of go hand in hand. I think when you're a kid, you kind of make whatever kind of infects you early, whether it's the jokes or the superheroes, it kind of determines what kind of, you know, storyteller you become.
Yeah, that's true. I feel that's true.
Yeah. 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 What is it with storytellers and animation and stand-up comedy? I heard you say that you have this you know, curiosity, this thing.
Oh, for... I mean, yeah, like stand-up to me is like, it's the opposite of what we do, where it's like immediate, and, you know, it's like we're so far behind the camera in terms of our relationship to our audience, whereas stand-up is like you just go out there and yeah. You have to try stuff. But to some extent, what we do because of our process is similar to stand up in that we're always, you know, we're not committing to choices until we're sure those choices work. And so if you listen to a stand up comedian, it's like the way that they get an hour of material is that they take a year and they go out on the road and they try, you know, like 40 hours of jokes to get that good hour of material. And they're constantly honing and refining, which is very similar to what we do. The only difference is like they get that immediate either like failure or gratification from an audience, and it takes us a few years. But I think there's something really like, if the audience doesn't laugh, your joke isn't working, and you can blame the audience, but that won't get you very far. No. You know what I mean? Like, so you're always listening. Like that's a big part of, I think, directing or even as a story artist. Like, I always found when I would put my idea up, like I took a script and I would break it and I would, you know, draw it out and put it up on the wall. The first time I pitched it, like 90% of what I'm trying to do is memorize my material so I can listen more than I can talk. You know, as you're stepping through the board, like you just sort of want to be able to hear where the laughs are, where people are engaging, because you can feel it in a room.
Yeah.
When something's working. So I that's where I think it's very similar to stand up. You're always trying to get that sense of what's working and what's not working based on the trial and error of throwing it on the wall.
Yeah. Have you done stand up?
Nope. One of the things when I was a kid, my parents, weirdly blue collar farming type people, they made me do this thing called Toastmasters, which was like public speaking. And I hated it, but then I kind of started to like it. And I guess I had a bit of an aptitude towards it, but man, does that ever serve me well in life? Like just being able to, you know, talk to a crew or, yeah. You know, pitch an idea to executives or try to sell something. It's that was like a good skill to have, but I kind of feel like if I ever, you know, get turfed out of animation, that might be the next move, is to start a new career as a stand-up art.
Yeah. Oh, well, I would see that as special.
Have you drawn or written comics?
Yeah, I mean, like again, it was more like the those kind of 3-4 panel setup joke comics. But like, I think the first thing I ever got published when I was like, 9, 10 years old, was a goat comic in the Pygmy Goat Society of Ontario, because we raise pygmy goats. They're those kind of useless little goats that mm-hmm. don't do much, except there was a big boom in the 80s for like pygmy goats as pets, and so we got in on that one. So my mom was like a big pygmy goat person. So yeah, I got some comics published that way. And then like over the years, I used to do comics and stuff for like school papers and everything. But weirdly enough, like my career actually, like I came out of high school and found my way to a school in Ontario called Sheridan, but I didn't really know it was there until my last year of high school, and then got right into animation. And at the time it was, like the industry was starting to really boom. So like I was kind of lucky. I never had that gray area between, you know, being that kind of kid in high school who did comics and tattoos so people wouldn't beat me up, to being, you know, a professional making and a living in an industry. So, yeah, I didn't have that kind of moment where it was like that entrepreneurial, just do my own comic thing. How about you guys? Are you still doing comics and stuff?
Yeah, actually, I edited a comic book anthology a few years ago.
Oh, yeah?
For some years, yeah. I used to gather some stories from other friends and colleagues and publish them indie way.
We used to do that a lot. Like, actually, two of my friends, John Hoffman, who's at Pixar, and Craig Berry, who's now back at Sony, we used to do a comic every year and try to do all the festivals, like whether it's like Ape in San Francisco, or like, I think it's in LA now, but it was in San Francisco mm-hmm. at the time, or Comic-Con and stuff like that. Yeah, then I, you know, then the kids started getting big, and then, you know, started to direct stuff, and there's no time anymore.
But I like, know.
Yeah, that was always fun. It was always fun to do.
I know. Nowadays, yeah. I teach sequential art in college now, and I feel like, well, I give the kids some comic book theory and comic book practice, and I have nothing published for, I don't know, 8 years now, and I feel like
really?
I don't know.
But what do you think is the...
Just because he's doing tons of stuff, so it's normal, and then I tell him not to worry about it, but because it was such a lot of work that he did before publishing that anthology.
Yeah.
So I tell him, no, your work, it's something, it's showing that you know this.
But that guilt, that little nagging, I should do more, is a healthy thing. Like that sort of, because someday, you know, might even be towards the end of this pandemic, you'll just have a comic in you and you'll just get it cracked down.
I try, because, you know, you surely know about this. You have one idea and you're writing one idea, but you're drawing another idea and you're thinking about another idea.
I think that's healthy to kind of have like five things going on. Like it
gives you
good for the brain.
What
do you think is the biggest difference between drawing comics and doing
boards,
like a TV show or a movie?
It's like the narrative about it. Just because for breaking down a comic page, you have to follow some lecture and to guide the eye. Some way it's a form of art, as everybody in the industry would say. Will Eisner said it. So you have to guide the lecture of the reader. So it's beautiful in that way, because you have to be creative and you can have a voice and style when doing that in just one page, and you decide how many panels you want to put in that page, how many expressions and all the tools you have to dress it and to draw it. It's beautiful. And in the other kind of sequence, the other kind of sequential art, that is the audiovisual, you know, the multimedia, the television, the feature for the boards, that kind of storytelling is different, because you have to be more specific with expressions. Every time you have to be more specific. Oh, of course, depending on the project, but it's different. Both of them are you know,
awesome.
And they're easy to fall in love with.
Yeah.
Both of them.
But I feel like a comic is like this invitation to look at a piece of art, where it's like you're inviting the audience to participate. Like you say, you can move the eye around, but they can dictate the pace of sort of how they want to consume it. Whereas like in sequential kind of film storytelling, it's like you basically hold the hand of the audience and you walk them through what you want them to see. And so because there's that 24 frames per second and time's going and it, you know, to rewind something, it's impossible if you're in a movie theater, but if you're at home, it's a pain in the ass and most people don't. So it's like, you want to make sure you don't lose them as you go one direction.
Yeah, but in comic books, it works the same. You know, as a reader, you can easily jump through pages or go through pages. So you have, as a writer, as a drawer, you have, as an artist, you have to keep the attention of the readers. So it works both ways. And as you say, for TV or for features, you get them on hand and either pacing or composition or whatever tools you have, you know, the cinematography, you can tell a story within a frame. So that's also beautiful.
I'm a huge fan of Sandman. I don't know if you're familiar with those comics.
Yeah.
Gaiman. So I just was rereading the comics and then because I got the audiobook. So then I listened to the audiobook and it was interesting sort of like how efficient the comics are compared to how he had to kind of almost recreate it to make it work in an audiobook. And I'm really curious to see how the movie is going to be or the TV show on Netflix. But
yeah,
it's just, it's almost like a very, you almost have to think about it like for how that audience is going to consume it. And just there's different pros and cons.
Yeah.
It's going to be really interesting. And I was about to ask you if there was any like comic book not yet been taken to the big screen, if you would like to see, you know, talking.
It's funny because I'm always skeptical when it kind of like leaps from like the comic to the big screen. Like I am curious about Sandman. That was one I loved when I was a kid and I'm excited to see what they do with it. But also like kind of a little apprehensive about just, you know, that experience. Although like with Good Omens, which wasn't a comic, it was a novel. Nice. Like I love that translation. I thought, you know, I there's something about the way that we've kind of HBO'd everything these days. Like there's so many great you know, like miniseries that almost like these comics and these longer form narratives, they fit better in that medium. So I am excited about that. Neverwhere is one I'm dying. I'm a huge Neil Gaiman fan, but like I'm dying to see Neverwhere realize well. I think, you know, there's always been this sort of quest to get a Kevin and Hobbes film. And I think that's been something that Bill Watterson's always sort of pushed against. And I kind of wish that it was more relevant now. So like, just because like a lot of young people don't know about his work and they have to discover it, which is great. But if there was a way to kind of execute that in a way that didn't hurt the source material, I think the technology has come to a place where you could get away with it. Like you could actually make those comics come to life. And I don't know. I think the world right now with like all the discourse and anxiety and anger out there, I think we could use somebody thinking thoughtfully about, you know, the psychology of what it means to be a kid. And I think that material would do well.
Oh, that would be awesome. I agree with that. I feel that way precisely with, I don't know if you know this character, Mafalda.
No, I don't.
It's an Argentinian character that it was really popular back in the day. And I really enjoyed it because she also did like a really, the character did a really good message about the world and everything, but through a kid's eyes. So
yes.
I thought it was super ingenious. And she has had some small adaptations, but never like something big. So I feel what you feel about doing an adaptation like that for a character that was so meaningful, but maybe it has been kind of forgotten over the years in that way.
It's an interesting point of view because it's like a lot of like when you're looking at the big box office like films, like they tend to want like that kid point of view, but through the lens of like an older character, like a teenager or like an early adult. And that kid point of view is such a, I don't know, it's such a powerful thing. And I think with the streaming opportunities, because people will watch things younger than themselves if they're home, they won't go to the theater to see it. So like a movie like The Willoughbys, say, which is about a children's point of view, even though it was all adult comedians playing the kids, you know, our opportunity to get that movie made, it really changed because of the consumption patterns of audiences, because people are watching stuff at home. So there might be opportunities for some of this stuff to come forward.
Yeah. Did you watch the Peanuts movie?
I did, and I think it actually was one of those cases where I think the box office was felt to be soft because of the fact that it was a thing for kids, about kids. But I think to where it's going with the Apple product, I mean, they've got the there's a few series coming out and they're doing these CoView specials, and I'm excited about those because I love Charles Schulz, and I loved his, like, again, it's very similar to Waterston, where it's like the kid's point of view, but it wasn't written for kids. Like, the kids, they weren't talking down to the audience in any way, shape, or form. There was a real intelligence and thought to the emotional, you know, situation, and what's funny about those emotional situations with children. So I think it's going to be great when all that stuff comes out to the world.
Yeah, that's true. And I really enjoyed the look and feel, you know, and I feel like the technology is right there to, like, adapt all these things in a different manner. So let's hope that someday they do it in a respectful and interesting way.
Yeah, yeah. It's cool how the computer is, like, kind of gone through the cycle of, like, creating realism and, like, getting that down pretty seamlessly, and now we're making it create art, and we're kind of asking the computer to do what we were asking other mediums to do, whether it was like watercolor or oil. And I think it's, like, really interesting to see artists get their hands on these, you know, kind of tools. It's like taking our Ferrari and turning it into a pickup truck. Like, there's just something kind of neat about, you know, taking that creative choice based on what the content is asking for.
Yeah, that's, I don't know if you saw that that Don Bluth is also, like, doing a new studio because he feels like the world is ready for, like, a comeback for traditional mediums. And I was like, yeah, I feel like we do, because, like, for example, with the Spider-Verse, you saw, like, like, it was in 3D, but the look and feel had something about, like, old comic books that really the audience really liked it. So
yeah,
I think, like, it's a good assumption, I think.
Yeah, I think it's like Spider-Verse was a great example of, like, using that medium to do things that you couldn't do on paper, but you also, people hadn't conceived the computer as using the tools to kind of create that texture mapping or that kind of feeling of, like, that comic feeling on the page, and sort of like how that integrated with camera and how that integrated with the animation posing, strong 2D principles. Like, all of that was, like, you know, it's been in the works. Like, you can see, you know, the work that they did in Hotel T and the work that crew did on Cloudy, kind of all adding up to what was done on Spider-Verse. So, and I know all those guys, I'm back at Sony now, and it's just like it's just a really interesting trajectory of, like, seeing just that creative collaboration between animators that come from that 2D background and filmmakers that want to hit a different look and style, and production designers, and they're all engaging and everybody's coming up with this amazing stew of something original. Cool.
Yeah, but how about the Willoughbys? I mean, it was also based on a book, right? And
yes. And, like, the book had this sort of sketchy idea, but, like, you know, it was what I loved about Lois Lowry's writing is that she wasn't sentimental in the way that, you know, I think children's books have kind of gravitated towards, especially in North America. So it kind of had that Roald Dahl feeling. I don't know if you remember those old Roald Dahl books, how, like, you know, people were bad. And, like, the kids, not every kid was good either. There's a reality in that if you could find a sense of humor in it, you can talk about it. And compared to Frozen, where, like, there's villains and stuff, but, like, it didn't feel like there's just bad people in Matilda that are bad and you don't have to redeem them. And their motivation is they're just bad people. And there's something really childlike about that approach. And one of the things that I loved about her book was that it dealt with the kind of notion of what it meant to be a family. Like, this was like on all accounts, a good family. They had a big house and they had two parents and, you know, four kids, and, you know, that's sort of the American dream. And yet they didn't really like each other. And there was something really funny about that was sad, but also, like, to me, like, the journey of the movie is this sort of hopeful idea that, like, you can create your own family, and you can, it's never too late to choose love. It's never too late to sort of see each other in a different way. And I think that sort of, I don't know, it sort of felt like a good time to be talking about those things, because at the time they were building walls to keep ideas out of countries. And it was just like, I don't want to talk about that. I'd rather break down those walls. Like let's let ideas yes. in, and you can't stop it from happening. And it's and that's the hopeful thing. I think, you know, climate change is scary, but I know my kids are angry, and that makes me hopeful, you know? And so like all of that sort of in the book, even though it wasn't in the book, that was the idea. Like that was what got me excited is chewing on that forcefulness of the will of children to find a better way if they have to. So.
Yeah, and we have to. Well, I have to say that it was beautiful. Every scene was a perfect composition. Cinematography was beautiful. The art direction was awesome. It has some nice jokes with the perfect timing. I really loved it. The way you also had to be I don't know, economize.
Yeah, because I mean, there's that gift that you can look at. Like, so if you have $100 million and you can swing the camera and you can render every shot, you end up sort of you know, having a freedom that might change how you approach the content. So we had, you know, a much lower budget. And because we had a lower budget, we had to find a way to get the movie onto the screen. And so looking at a lot of the movies from the 70s that I grew up loving, so like Harold and Maude and MASH and, you know, The Party and Doctor Strangelove, like all of these films, like I was looking at all these dark comedies and what they didn't need was swinging camera. What they didn't need was, you know, a lot of dynamic video game style, you know, cinematography. You know, comedy really works well, especially going back to the sketch comedy thing. You know, it's like Three Stooges. You lock your camera, you let the audience know where the joke is going to be, and then either give it to them or you surprise them with a misdirect. You know what I mean? And it's all about the camera supporting the acting and the acting allowing its, like having the room to be what it needs to be. And Kyle McQueen, our production designer, he is a genius. And he just sort of, like every shot between the conversation of like storyboards and production design, because we were shooting practical, our the way we built our sets, the way we sort of allowed ourselves, you know, the rules of the camera, we were able to compose things really specifically. And so the kind of almost like the lack of our render problems led us to being really economical when it came to how we set up our shots. So
yeah, like the size of the house. I noticed how you change the size, you know, the proportions of the house or the sets to just to tell better the frame. It was beautiful. Yeah. It was beautiful. I have to say it was beautiful. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I mean, the other big influence, like for me growing up, was always like sitcom. So like, you know, growing up on a farm, the same way as like comics were something that would come in the newspaper, you know, I didn't get to the theater like maybe three times a year. So I would obsessively watch things on TV. And so like shows like Three's Company and All in the Family and again, MASH and like these sort of, sitcom shows that were obviously shot on a soundstage, like that kind of three camera setup was like a big part of, I think, my influence of what I find entertaining. And so we really tried to put that into the film, which was good for our budget, but also I think created a very unique look for our storytelling. And so we basically took that all the way through. So we used strong 2D principles for our characters. It was all about silhouette. And we took out motion blur and we shot things on twos. And anytime we'd move the camera, we'd have to snap to ones. And so we'd have to hide the fact that our movement was like more realistic than it should be. So quite often we'd off time something. So like for example, when they're skidooing down or sledding down the top of that Alp, mm-hmm. the effects are all on twos while as the characters are on ones. And that as long as something gives you that off timing thing, I think it gives you that feeling of the world being handmade. So that was really important to us.
That's great. It's a great, great thing you're talking about. It's so exciting to know all these. So a lot of colleagues in the U.S. weren't aware of what the world, apart from Japan, was doing in the animation industry just a few years ago. So I dare to say it's so different nowadays. How do you see what the rest of the world is doing now?
Well, I mean, having been like kind of in the U.S. for most of my career, I feel like it was like eye-opening when I got an opportunity to go on junket for Cloudy 2, and we traveled around to different, we went to Russia, went all over Europe, went to South America, Argentina, Chile, and, you know, Mexico. And so, like, going to those festivals was really, and going to those different studios down there was sort of eye-opening. And at the time, to consume those films, you had to either wait till they got a U.S. distribution pickup, or, you know, you'd find an art house theater that was, like, showing some, you know, rare Russian animation or something. And these days, I feel like I Lost My Body was a really good case study in a film that was super clever, super smart, made for like a budget that made sense for the storytelling, and yet it found this huge audience. Or I was able to consume it in my home in Canada in a way that I wouldn't have. I'd have to work to find it if going back 5 years, you know. So I think that's the real exciting thing about what we're like kind of experiencing right now. And having said all this, like, I was always excited about international animation. Like, when I was coming up in school, like, there was these festivals, you guys know Spike and Mike, like, they'd come through Toronto and they'd play shorts and films from all over the world. But without those kind of curated festivals, it was really hard to find stuff. So nowadays, like, I just feel like, you know, we are making stuff for a global audience, and the global audience is making stuff to come back into our homes. And I think that's a really cool opportunity, I think, for the world to see stuff that's new. Yeah.
Do you have any country in particular we should keep an eye on in terms of animation?
Well, I mean, it's hard not to look at like what's happening in Spain and France as a constant, like, interesting hotbed for artists and storytellers. I don't know what it is about the water over there, but they seem to make people who can draw like crazy. And like, it's,
especially in France.
And the style, yeah, you know?
I mean, I have a long relationship with the SIGGRAPH people in Chile, and I'm very excited to see what's sort of bubbling up down there. And there's some interesting studios making interesting things. And same in Argentina. Like, I think the that studio that made, was it a football, or it was called Underdogs or something in North America. But like, yeah, it was a really, like, you know, it was one of those films that you start to see, you know, again, the filmmakers get their handle on the technology and finding ways to make it look good in the box that it's in. So, you know, I'm excited to see what comes out of there. I keep talking about this one movie because it's one of those films that really affected me. But have you seen Boy in the World? Like, I just love that film. And it was out of Brazil.
The Brazilian, remember, yeah.
Yeah, I remember beautiful. That one. Like, I saw it because it was in the Oscar run. And so, like, being in the States, like, we got to see the Oscar films. And I bought the DVD on that one. And it's one of those films I just watch a lot, and it makes me cry. And I love the simplicity of sort of how the storytelling was served by the music and just the way the narrative comes together. So I don't know. I mean, I'm always surprised by stuff. And it's like, what you don't see coming is the stuff that's often the most interesting. So,
yeah, that's true. And as we were saying, this is really unpredictable, and you never know where the next, like, really interesting new idea is going to come out, right?
Yeah. And I just hope that, like, people can find an audience telling the stories that mean something to them. You know, I do think if you hit your, I mean, unabashedly, The Willoughbys is a very Canadian film. Like, it's a story about diversity told from the point of comedy. And if you look at all of the, you know, the stuff I grew up watching from, again, Kids in the Hall to SCTV, like, you know, or even like Schitt's Creek, which just cleaned up in the Emmys, like, that to me is a very Canadian idea of, you know, finding humor in the banality of being in the middle of nowhere. And I think that, that notion of like identity, like, I don't know why, but I Lost My Body feels like a very, you know, kind of French movie. It just sort of has that sort of quirkiness that is dark, but there's a funny heart to it, which I think is very, you know, it feels like it comes from that place that has a voice. And so I'm excited to see what other stuff comes up.
And you know what, we are really excited to also know what a little bit more about what you are doing right now, you know, like
I went back to Sony beginning of this year. I actually started there 3 days before the pandemic lockdown. So currently I'm just working on I've got about 5 or 6 projects in development, and we'll see what happens. It's those seeds in the ground.
So I've talked to other colleagues about this, and some have been really troubled thinking about it. You know, doctors heal, farmers grow food. There are several professions with a tangible impact in society.
Right.
Us as storytellers, what's our place within society? Do we contribute? How do we contribute to the world?
Well, I mean, we pay taxes, which is good. So we, you know. I don't know. I mean, I feel like, you know, there's a lot of discourse about the value of art. And I think when you look at troubled times, I think, you know, art is a way of explaining, you know, how we feel about our emotions in terms of survival and going through experiences. Now, the big question is whether what we do is art. You know, it's a commercial medium and it's a business. And we are, you know, basically kind of working in a craft is the way I always like to look at animation, right? And you can't eat cartoons, but I think people need escape. And I think if you look at, again, like, I know that we're not creating, you know, corn or bullets or, you know, PPE or any of that, but we're providing, you know, opportunities for people to, you know, have emotions, a place to sort of laugh or have a place to cry or have a place to, you know, escape from the reality of the pain of the world and sort of have a moment of joy. I think that's important. And I think it's part of the human spirit. So I don't know. I feel like a world without cartoons isn't a world I want to live in, even with all the food and, you know, medical attention.
I get it. And I agree completely because I feel like right now the world feels like such a crazy, surreal place. So we need like something to keep ourselves together. You know, it really, truly helps to have like this kind of entertainment that has a message, but also helps you and takes you to another place for a little while. So you can gain some perspective and then come back and try to fix all the things that are happening all around the world.
I also think it's really hard to know how your ideas travel. And like there's a weird shelf life to animation, how it lives for a long time. It doesn't quite age in the same way as other films. But like, if I think of like the films when I was a kid, like I remember going to see 101 Dalmatians in the theater or Secret of Nim or, you know, An American Tale. And those films at their core, like if you look at An American Tale, it's a story of empathy. It's a story of, you know, finding a way to belong as you kind of travel from the place you came from to a new home. And I arguably same with Dalmatians, you know, or like, you know, Fox and the Hound is the story about race. And while these films don't necessarily, you know, scream it at you, these little kind of like seeds of empathy get planted in your soul. And I think, I don't know. I think that matters. I think it's a force for good.
That's true. And besides, those are the ideas that are like influencing like kids because it's really hard sometimes to like change the minds of adults, but kids are so sensitive to everything that they are learning in that stage. So I think that's true. And it's really important like to keep, you know, those ideas in front of them so they can realize a new perspective.
And I love how that, like, I think storytelling is able to approach it from a human, like, almost like that human experience without an agenda of, because we've all, like, if you're a human being, regardless of your politics, regardless of your birth origin, like, what country you're from, we all fall in love. We all experience, you know, the comedy of embarrassment or the anxiety of failure. And we all have moments of joy that is, you know, undercut by the pathos of, you know, loss. And I think that kind of idea of like framing those human emotions gives us something to relate to, which is really important. And I got that from like Calvin Hobbes, like, you know, the idea of like a kid who's, you know, got an imaginary friend who's really got a grown up point of view of the world, but this sort of need to be a kid. I don't know. There's something about that collision of grown up ideas against the, you know, a naked bum running through a classroom. Like that's, we all feel that. And I think that gives you a framework to kind of accept yourself and permission to be funny.
if that adaptation never comes out, I hope you have the chance to work on that movie in any capacity because it seems that you really love it.
I'd be afraid to. I wouldn't want to ruin it.
No, but it would be awesome. I mean, it's a project you've always loved and have the opportunity to I don't know, to place a tribute or something to it, you know, like homage. Yeah. It would be great.
Maybe someday. Maybe someday. Right. We'll let the internet tell us what's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. Let's plant that seed right now. If you could live in any fictional world, which one would be and why?
Any fictional world? I don't know. That's a good question. No one's ever asked me that. I think I like living in this world. As much as it's going to shit, I think any world I was living in, if it was too nice, I don't know if I'd have an imagination. I think it's good to have a world that you want to imagine a better version of to create the art. So I'm pretty happy in Canada here.
That's great.
Yeah,
the fictional world of Canada.
Yeah. It sounds like a fictional world sometimes for us all in this part of the world.
Chris, are you open for some youngsters, students, or some young professionals to get in touch with you via Twitter or Instagram or some social media?
Yeah, I'm pretty not great on social media. So, but if anybody ever wants to reach out, emails my name, chrisperrin@gmail.com. And I am on Facebook and Instagram. I'm just not too active there. I find it soaks up a lot of my creative bandwidth. So yeah, I'm always open and I love meeting new people. And it's a real honor to be able to talk to people in this industry. So
our time is almost up. We just want to thank you for your time. And we want to tell you and let you know that this podcast is your house. You can come chat with us whenever you want. If you want to say something to Latin America, Mexico, whatever, you can come to us and talk. Man,
I really hope the world opens up and, I can get down to Cuernavaca for the next year's Pixar.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Literally show up at your house. I would, because I'm happy to do that. I'll bring whatever you want to drink.
Man, this is your home.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Oh, man. Oh, no, man. You've opened the doors. Hell. We have mezcal. We have beer. We have tequila. We have everything. Whatever you need.
Same thing goes for you guys. If you're ever north of the 49th, you got a place to crash.
Oh, thank you.
Awesome.
Thank
you. We will bring some tequila and mezcal and
mezcal.
Everything.
Mezcal is better than tequila. Yeah.
I'll bring whiskey and beer. And I think your alcohol will always win because it's got it gets to my skull quicker.
And you have a house here to crash on, man. Always. Awesome. It's been awesome. Such an honor. Such a pleasure to talk to
Thanks
you.
Thanks a
Thank
lot.
You guys. Thank you so much. And I wish you guys good health and hopefully we'll see you soon in person.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah,
let's hope so.
Yeah.
Awesome.
See All you.
Right, see you later.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
Esa fue nuestra entrevista con Chris Perrin. Yo estoy súper contenta de que se haya dado un tiempo de platicar con nosotros. Estoy un poco traumada porque justo en esa entrevista le andaba platicando de lo mucho que había sido una influencia Mafalda en la vida de muchos artistas latinoamericanos y vamos teniendo la noticia de esta semana. Fue muy triste. Pero fuera de eso, la plática estuvo muy buena. Me encantó todo lo que platicó y su actitud es lo máximo. De verdad que les recomiendo mucho que si ustedes tienen oportunidad de luego verlo en otras pláticas, lo aprovechen.
Eres como el martillo negro tú, porque hablamos con Cinema Fantasma y justo dices, ¡ay, el cristal encantado! Cancelado. Y ahorita, fíjate, hablabas de Mafalda y sopas, perico.
Ah, ya sé, yo también me quedé así, ¿de qué se trata? Sí, se me hizo súper triste, ya no voy a decir las cosas que me gustan.
Ya no recomiendes nada, porque al rato, cancelado, Fruits Basket, cancelado.
No.
¡Oh, por Dios! ¡Mate a Potter!
Sí, no. Qué chistosa. Qué como los de Top Chef. Bueno, ya. Sí. Es que ustedes no están para saber contarlo, pero gracias a Renata, ahora veo puros realities de cocina. Ya soy yo más, como más baby boomer de lo que era antes. Ahora prefiero quedarme en casa arropado a tomar vino y ver realities de comida. Antes no hacía eso.
¡Ay, su máximo!
Yo antes no hacía eso.
Es el mejor plan de fin de semana.
Es tu culpa.
Y me da gusto.
Es el descaro con el que son capaces de llegar.
Oigan, ya vimos también, ¿cómo se llama esta serie?
Close Enough.
Close Enough. Ya vimos también Close Enough de J.G. Quintel. Les vamos a traer la reseña pronto. De entrada les puedo decir que es muy buena. Muy identificados estuvimos.
Sí, la verdad, sí, nos reímos mucho.
Este fin de semana también haremos un live stream a través de Facebook. Así es que si todavía no nos siguen en Facebook, ahí estamos como Viñetas por Segundo. Denos seguir. Y el sábado en la tardecita vamos a hacer un live. Les confirmamos la hora esta semana a través de Facebook para que nos acompañen y nos puedan preguntar todo lo que quieran y platiquemos un ratito. Les vamos a platicar más o menos de lo que queremos. ¿Qué pase con el podcast? ¿Qué esperamos del podcast? ¿Hasta dónde queremos llegar? ¿Cómo inicia la idea? Podemos platicar un poquito más de nosotros, porque por ahí también nos están preguntando acerca de qué trayectoria tenemos y ustedes quiénes son que están siendo interrogadas ahí. Vamos a hablar un poco de eso también, de por qué queremos tanto la animación y por qué estamos haciendo esto. Este fin de semana, este sábado, vamos a hacer el live stream a través de Facebook, Viñetas por Segundo, y para que nos acompañen, están todos cordialmente invitados, y pues eso.
Eres un excelente promotor.
¡Pásenle, pásenle! Voy a ponerme a bailar como la botarga de cine. Hay unas que bailan muy bien.
Voy a hacer una pequeña recomendación para todos los que les gusten los cuentos divertidos y que les guste apoyar a los ilustradores independientes. Este pequeño cuento llamado Mamá, yo solo quiero perrear. De nuestro queridísimo amigo Quique Follo. Es un cuento que sacó él de por sí antes en sus redes sociales y que ahora hizo una edición impresa junto con Mikolen and Kevelin. Y es un cuento sumamente simpático, de verdad se los recomiendo mucho. Básicamente, aparte tiene un mensaje bastante bueno de tolerancia que me sorprendió, porque pues realmente él es como muy chistosito, ¿no? O sea, no, tú no te pensarías que va por ese camino. Pero es de un niño que le encanta bailar reggaetón y se siente muy mal porque su familia pues habla mucho de que el reggaetón es una porquería, que está horrible y todo.
Así se les dice, manacos.
Tiene muy buenos argumentos a favor de, bueno, pero es la música de ahora y de alguna manera no tienes por qué hacerlo sentir mal al chico por lo que le gusta. Y habla un poquito de comprensión desde una forma muy divertida. Tú también ya lo viste, tú ya viste que es divertido.
Sí, yo no, al contrario de Renata, yo no quiero dar spoilers. Yo creo que lo que deberían de hacer es comprarlo, apoyar a Quique a través de su Instagram, que Renata se los va a dar en cuanto yo deje de hablar, porque es un cuentito que está, es muy sencillo, el arte es muy sencilla, pero es muy efectiva, el mensaje es muy bonito, es gracioso, te deja una muy buena sensación después de haberlo leído, y dices, mira, qué padre, rápido, conciso, al punto y bonito, ¿no? Es un muy buen proyectito. Espero que Quique siga sacando cosas así, que le meta un poquito más de ganas al arte para que complemente todavía mejor, más de lo, o sea, mejor de lo bien que está, todavía mejor su mensaje, porque es bueno narrando, Quique. Quique, deberías hacer más cosas de estas.
Sí, totalmente. A Quique lo pueden encontrar en Instagram, así, Quique Follo, todo junto.
Con Y.
Con Y, sí. Y pues ahí él está haciendo pues envíos de su cuento y la verdad es que es un trabajo bonito, no está muy caro y pues estarían apoyando a un artista independiente con una idea bastante simpática.
Sí, la verdad está bueno y espero que esto le sirva de apoyo a Quique para que haga más cosas porque tiene una voz interesante, narrativamente sí. Hablando. Muy bien, Quique. Viñetas por Segundo, aprueba. Oye, y la Muma tenía algo que decir, ¿no? La Muma.
Ah, bueno, es que esto es extra porque aparte también es como en conjunto con Designare Media, que también ya hemos tenido nosotros aquí a Damner Jesús Chuy, uh-huh. El que es el fundador de Designare Media. Uh-huh. Y solo quiero decirles a todas las que nos escuchan que Muma y Designare se unieron para poder ofrecer algo muy bueno a quienes manden su portafolio al correo de Muma, muma.información@gmail.com, para hacerse acreedoras de poder ir a View, bueno, no poder ir, pero poder presenciar View Conference, que es un evento enfocado en el VFX, el CGI, 3D y más efectos visuales. No puedo decir demasiado todavía, pero les digo que vale mucho la pena. Por favor, participen, porque lo que se va a ofrecer vale mucho, mucho la pena. Entonces, por favor, participen. ¿Y qué más? Aparte, por ejemplo, a Chris Byrne también lo van a poder ver ahí. Y a Jorge Gutiérrez.
No, mucha gente. La verdad, también, o sea, va a haber muchos invitados de categoría en ese evento y vale mucho la pena que participen. Nada más es para chicas, ¿verdad?
El de Muma sí, pero designar en media. Pero designar en media tiene también aparte otra dinámica donde pueden ser hombres y mujeres.
Entonces hay que ir a seguir a designar en media y decirle, Chuy, quiero mis boletos, dámelos ahora, por favor. Yo solo quiero perrear y esas cosas.
Exacto. Así que bueno, esos son los anuncios de la semana.
Quique debería sacar una playera que diga, yo solo quiero perrear.
Sí, sí, estaría buenísimo. Yo con sí la compraría.
Bonito. Yo también con el bonito. En blanco, en negro, en rosa. En rosa. Uy, en rosa en con rosa. Verde, así todos fluorescentes. Oh, Quique. Te estás tardando.
Sí.
Oye, sí, también tazas.
Sí, no, yo, la verdad es que este personaje no sé si tiene nombre, pero a mí me encanta. Sí, compraría muchas cosas de él.
Yo creo que es Quique.
No sé, que nos venga a sacar de la duda.
Sí, Quique, a ver cuándo platicamos aquí en el podcast, Quique.
Sí.
Que te animes a platicar, porque luego estás todo así. Ya lo estoy quemando aquí.
Ya déjale un paso.
Que venga aquí, que sea a defenderse. Entonces, si ya no hay más, les recuerdo que nos pueden escuchar en Spotify, iTunes, iVoox, Anchor, Google Podcast, Pocket Podcast y más plataformas. Obviamente en YouTube, obviamente también estamos en Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, @UPPS Podcast, viñetas por segundo, mami. Viñetas por segundo, mami. Yeah. Tu podcast favorito. Animación. Yeah. Pues sí, esto ha sido todo por nuestra cuenta. Ya no les queremos anunciar, todavía no les podemos anunciar el invitado de la siguiente semana. Estamos tratando de dejar menos espacio entre entrevistas, entonces estamos todavía cerrando la de la siguiente semana, pero viene buena. Parece que ser que viene muy buena también. De todas formas, para el año que entra también vienen invitadazos y vienen cosas buenas, vienen cosas padres.
Sí, totalmente. Nos estamos poniendo las pilas.
Y para los 1,500 suscriptores, vamos a regalar cosas bien chidas, cosas como voces virtuales y cosas así de las que ya no voy a hablar. Pero sí, cosas padres.
Sí, sí, sí.
Muy bien.
Así que estén atentos.
Nos escuchamos y nos vemos la próxima semana. O antes, dependiendo. Hasta siempre, adelante.
Bye.